This is Aviator Cast, Episode 3. Let's fly it like a boss.
Calling all aviators, pilots, and aviation lovers. Welcome to Aviator Cast, where we close the gap between real aviation and flight simulation. Climb aboard, buckle up, and prepare for takeoff. Here's your host, Chris Palmer.
Welcome, 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 aviators. You've landed at Aviator Cast. My name is Chris Palmer. I love everything about flying, from kissing cloud tops to perfecting procedures, and from the roar of GE engines to the sound of a simple four banger. Just call me Mr. Crazy Cloud Tops. Yes, I'm a real pilot, but I also have a love and appreciation for flight simulation. Both complement each other and have largely shaped me into the pilot and aviator I am today. I'm the founder and owner of Angle of Attack, a flight simulation training company, which is bringing you this podcast today. So I really hope you're enjoying Aviator Cast so far. Our first episode was just released, even though this is episode 3. Episode 1 just barely came out. We're getting some great feedback so far. And, you know, this type of feedback really energizes me as the producer of this show to keep going and going and going and keep producing this content, and motivates me just to keep trucking at it. So I had a great review from Ron. Ron left a comment on our blog at aviatorcast.com. If you go over there, you can find that. And for any episode, we have show notes, so you can go there and comment on the show and say how you felt about it, so on and so forth. And we had several comments on the first episode of Aviator Cast, and one particular comment that really stood out to me and just got me so excited was something that Ron said. So Ron said, "Great Aviator Cast, very inspirational, and just the push I needed to head out to the airport and sign up for lessons. At 47, I finally have the opportunity and financial means to pursue this passion. I might not have the time that I'd like to dedicate to two or more lessons a week, but your Aviator 90 and Aviator Pro training products have given me a good foundation and the confidence to make it through lessons as efficiently as possible. Looking forward to many more episodes. You're the best. Thanks for all you do for the aviation community." Thank you, Ron. That is such an awesome review, and I'm so excited that you've decided to start your lessons. And even at 47 years old, it is not too late to go out and get your pilot's license and start this process. It'll be such a great joy to you, and I know that you'll do well, and I can tell that you're very passionate about it. And the fact that you're here gaining more knowledge with things like Aviator Cast and the other things that Angle of Attack does just means that you're going to be that much further ahead in your training. So congratulations on that big step, Ron. And big props to you for maybe literally too, right? But big props to you for starting your training. So if you would like to leave a review, it really helps us out, not only from, I guess, an energizing standpoint, helping me and the company keep pushing this podcast forward, but also it helps others know that this is something worth listening to. You can do that straight on our blog. That's one good place to get in touch with us directly where we can actually reply to you. However, a more public place and something that actually means a lot for the podcast and getting the name of Aviator Cast out there is actually on iTunes. So if you search iTunes and you go to reviews and ratings, then you can actually review and rate the show, and that will pop up and, you know, we'll get 5 stars, for example, and it'll show people that this is a great podcast, worth downloading, worth listening to, worth getting into. So if you could do that, if you don't do anything else and you actually do enjoy this podcast, that would be much appreciated by me and by the team. So first and foremost, above anything else, is thank you for being here. Thank you for being a part of what we do. We really do enjoy interacting with you one-on-one and really hope that you continue to be a part of our community, or we hope that you will stay and be a part of our community. So welcome. Thank you. And, you know, I'm just really excited for this particular episode. And you know, we just love our trainees and we love the aviators here at Angle of Attack. So today's flight plan, we have two great segments for you that are quite unrelated, but still quite fun to talk about. You're sure to learn a thing or two to help you along the way. And, you know, they are very different subjects, but, you know, I think you'll really enjoy them. So the first is our flight training segment. As always, we'll touch on what makes solid IFR aviators. This is actually quite a large subject. I'm going to have to kind of speed through some of the points that I have, but I felt like this just flowed onto the page in my show notes, and that there is a lot to learn here in what makes a solid IFR aviator. So we'll definitely talk about that, you know, the attributes, the attitudes, the aptitudes that you need to become a solid IFR pilot. And then for you virtual aviators out there, I know you'll love this one. And also for you prospective jet pilots and even you aviator, you know, you generally aviation guys, that love or just rather would want to know how to do this. We'll talk about how to nail virtual jet landings every time. So we'll talk about the myths, the challenges, and I also came up with an acronym that will help you out a lot in this particular procedure, and also the differences between landing varying aircraft, because obviously landing a smaller jet is going to be much different from landing some of the bigger heavies out there. So that is what we have in store for you today. That is today's flight plan. So let's get into the flight training segment.
And now the flight training segment.
What makes a solid IFR aviator? Pilots and aviators often approach IMC or instrument meteorological conditions with too much caution when first obtaining their instrument ticket. Why get an instrument ticket if you aren't going to use it in the actual conditions? Although many pilots are simply obtaining an instrument ticket on the way to a career, for example, and you know the primary reason of getting their instrument ticket is to, you know, advance and get to the next rating, we believe that we should approach this IFR pilotship, if you will, from a different perspective. Why not work to achieve confidence in IMC, or instrument meteorological conditions, clouds for example, rather than just another check mark on your way to that career? What will happen when these necessary skills are called into action during real-world flight, and although you have that rating, you don't have the confidence to perform the tasks? Here we'll discuss some of the topics, but you know, certainly not all, and these are just things that you should be familiar with in becoming that solid IFR aviator. So let's now discuss some of the subjects that you should focus on while undoubtedly missing some important subjects. So sorry about that. This is just a lot of stuff to cover in one episode. I think some of these sections we could focus on for just one whole episode, and you know, maybe we'll do that sometime in the future. We could definitely talk about these subjects quite a bit. Just stand alone on their own. Okay, so we're going to go through some different subjects here. They have some titles that are a little bit catchy, and so you might be able to remember them, and I'll tell you what those are now. So we're going to talk about weather wisdom. We'll also talk about system savvy, communication clarity, predictable procedures, conditioning, sailing safely, and parting the clouds. So that will conclude the you know, solid IFR aviator subject. And obviously there's a lot to cover there. You know, each one of those subjects has a lot to cover. So let's get right in. The first that I mentioned is weather wisdom. So knowing your weather and what to expect does come with experience, but there is an incredible amount of work you can do ahead of time. The biggest thing is to get prepared, get briefed, and know the scenarios before you, and then monitor those changes while you're en route, because undoubtedly things will be different from what your reports were before you go. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you just go out and fly in whatever weather. You need to know what you're getting into, but it will be slightly different from what was reported. So we're trying to minimize a risk and trying to be as familiar as possible with the situation but we aren't going to be able to have a full and perfect picture of what's going on unless you're in an area where it's just absolutely perfect wind and or zero wind, perfect weather, which is I have found to be extremely rare. So some of the things that we need to be concerned about when talking about weather and IFR, icing is definitely one of them. You know, do you know how to read an icing map and seeing the different levels of those icing maps and the predictions and estimating that around your time of departure? So do you have the skills to gain an overall picture of the icing conditions and determine if it will actually be safe to fly? Now, icing is obviously a very rare, it is actually a rare instance. It takes perfect conditions for icing to form, but that obviously doesn't mean it doesn't happen because it does happen. And it is something as pilots, especially IFR pilots, we have to be aware of. So although it is rare, it still is quite dangerous. So when you go into these conditions, if you do plan on going into these conditions, obviously you can't fly into known icing conditions unless your aircraft is set up for that. So you also need to know what your aircraft is capable of. You know, there's also instances where you determine the risk, right? So obviously if there's an area where there's a light probability of icing and you feel like you can get through that cloud layer quickly or whatever it is, then, you know, that's something that you have to weigh and ask yourself, you know, is this something that I can do? So you just need to know, first of all, you need to know how to read all of these icing maps. You need to know how to get an overall picture of this situation. You need to be educated on the subject, and I can give you something in the show notes that will teach you how to do that and give you a really great look at icing from a scientific perspective. And then you obviously need to know what the aircraft can handle as well. And apart from all that, you need to be communicative with air traffic control about the icing conditions, and you need to find out during the process what's going on, because obviously you don't want to get yourself in a situation where you're building a lot of ice that can become very dangerous. So there's this NASA course that they put together and they put online. It's multimedia. It's great. It teaches you a lot about icing from their perspective because they study this stuff constantly. And, you know, they're up there always learning more about icing conditions. So I will put the link to that NASA course in the show notes and you guys can check that out. That is one of the biggest sources I learned from and kind of dispelled a lot of the myths I felt about or knew about or thought I knew about icing was through that NASA course. So it dispels a lot of those myths, but it also shows you some extreme conditions with icing. And, you know, because there are conditions where icing is just absolutely incredible and it can take your aircraft down within a matter of minutes. So anyway, I'll link to that as well. So that's icing. Another thing you need to know, and we'll just touch on this briefly because this is just kind of basic. You need to know what the clouds are telling you. As an IFR pilot, you need to be able to look and say, you know, that one's a little darker. That's cumuliform. You need to know, you know, standing lenticular, you need to know what those types of clouds are telling you and really what all types of clouds are telling you. So you may want to study up a little bit on the differences between certain types of clouds, and you need to find out why to you as an IFR pilot that matters. You know, is that a type of cloud you can go through? Is that a type of cloud you should avoid? Is it worth requesting going around it from air traffic control? You need to know those things to just gain an overall picture of the situation. And obviously, clouds and icing are very closely related because icing doesn't happen in, you know, icing happens in moisture, essentially. So whether that's in a cloud or fog or actual rainfall, snow, things like that. Okay. So closely related to clouds, and we're done with clouds, but closely related to clouds is types of fog. So you need to know the different types of fog, how that fog phases in and out, and you know how you can plan ahead as an IFR pilot for those types of situations, because there are types of fog that will linger a very long time. There are types of fog that burn off as the day goes on. And although those situations aren't always exactly how it is, so even though it's a type of fog that essentially generally burns off, it doesn't mean that it's actually going to do that. But as a pilot, you can know that that might be a possibility, okay? So that's fog, just very, very general. Another thing that you should know about and perhaps study, and this one's a little bit harder, is what are the trends and unique attributes for the particular area you're in. So knowing the area you're flying into, you know, are you flying into the Rockies, or are you flying into the plains, or are you flying into a coastal town? What type of area are you flying into? What are the challenges of that particular airport or area? Each flight route is very unique and is going to take you across different areas that have different challenges to them. So you need to know what those challenges are. And the reason why this one is a little difficult is this stuff isn't necessarily published that well. You might find it in an airport facility directory, or you might find it on airnav.com for a specific airport. But if you're really concerned about a particular airport, you may want to ask other pilots that have flown into that airport what the conditions are like, idiosyncrasies about that particular airport. And you may want to, you could even call the FBO for that particular airport and ask to speak with a local pilot there if there's something you're actually really concerned about. I wouldn't bug people with that too much, but I would think that they are very open to actually talking about their local area. Because, you know, as we talked about before, you are planning or should plan on using your instrument ticket, flying in actual conditions. And so you want to get everything on your side and have as much information as possible. So having those area changes in mind or specific attributes about that area would be very important for you to know. So that's area changes. Another thing that you should do and you should make a habit of is having a multi-source brief. So you should not only be getting things from the flight service station, but you should also be relying on a lot of the online sources these days that are out there. And then there are a lot of great services that are available now live while you're in the cockpit, especially if you have something like an iPad where you can get actual current XM weather, for example. So a lot of different things you can get that will give you a broad scope and in a lot of situations, in most situations, cross verification of the information you're seeing. So getting an overall picture of the weather that you're going to be going into and flying through, because that's the point of all this, right? This is one of the biggest things as an IFR pilot you're going to be looking out for. And the largest thing that differentiates IFR flying from any other type of flying is that you are actively flying into weather and flying through it and around it. And you know, you're in the weather. And so that's the big thing you need to be, one of the biggest things you need to be aware of as a solid IFR aviator, if you will. So a couple more here for the weather wisdom is airport ground conditions. And this is very closely related to knowing information about that particular area. You should just know what type of area you're flying into, you know, what type of approaches are available, what it's going to be like once you get on the ground, what facilities are available, things like that, you know, and also what the taxiway and runway conditions are like, because it could have snowed the morning before and melted a little bit and cooled down, and so now it's icy. So you have a lot of these different considerations to keep in mind with the actual airport conditions. So that's important to keep in mind as well. And that is actually something that you could call an FBO about if you're concerned and see what the conditions are like on the ground, as far as even just taxiing around and braking action on the runway and what things are like. So that's something else you could do. Last but certainly not least, and I just threw this one in here because it fits pretty well here. It could also fit in our human factors area, which we'll talk about later, is nighttime. You need to ask yourself as a single IFR, single pilot, single engine IFR, if flying at nighttime in instrument conditions alone is the smartest thing to do. Now, obviously, if you're in the clouds and you can't see anything, you know, that definitely kind of negates the purpose of night and day, right? Like there's no difference if you're in the clouds, but once you're out of clean, once you're out of the clouds, you're not going to be in the clouds all the time. It's super rare. We are just going to be in thick, IFR all the time. Once you're out of the clouds, it does make a big difference to you from a safety perspective and just stacks the cards in your favor if you are not flying at nighttime and you're able to do a lot more visual things that you can do during daytime. So, you know, it's just really a personal choice, I suppose, is if you're willing to fly at night and if that's something you want to stack in your favor and try to fly during the day instead. Because there are dangers that come with nighttime flying that don't come with daytime flying. All right, so that's it for weather wisdom. Now, system savvy. So the IFR system is a very complex system, obviously, a complex set of procedures, traffic, and timing considerations. You need to know how you fit in all of this and how to fly efficiently in a system meant for high accuracy. And honestly, in a lot of cases, it's meant for airlines. It's meant for getting people reliably from point A to point B in pretty much any type of weather. So you need to familiarize yourself with certain things. And you need to ask yourself some of these questions that I'm about to ask. How does the IFR system work? You know, how does it all flow together? How do the controllers fit in with the pilots and the pilots with the controllers and the controllers with the ground crew? And, you know, all of these things, how does it all work together? And by knowing that, you can more efficiently operate in IFR. And that's the next question is, what is the most efficient way to fly in IFR? And that's one question that you need to always be asking yourself is, what is the most efficient way I can do this? You know, if you can find some sort of shortcut in your route, and I'm not saying taking a dangerous shortcut or something that was unplanned or just, you know, unpredictable, but rather, you know, maybe cutting a little corner from this VOR to that VOR instead of having another VOR in between or a waypoint. And saving yourself a few minutes. And so you arrive a little bit earlier, you save a little bit of fuel. You know, these are always things you need to be stacking in your favor. So what's the most efficient way? And again, that's a question you need to always be asking yourself. Another question, or rather a set of questions, is what are you trying to accomplish? Are you out there to experience the IFR, just to gain experience in IFR? Or are you trying to do it efficiently? So, or quickly, rather. Efficiently and quickly are closely related. I would say you're always looking to do it, not necessarily quickly, but with expediency. You're looking to do things the most efficient way you possibly can. And that's where you gain the most experience. And that's where you start to really understand how the IFR system works, although there is some book knowledge that goes with that as well. Another question you need to ask yourself is, do I need to be doing IFR the entire time? That's more of a, I guess, a personal question, what you're willing to put up with as far as clearances, because sometimes air traffic control can hold you on the ground. It takes way too long. You can depart VFR and get in the air and pick up IFR in the air and be just fine. So you need to ask yourself, do I want to do this the entire time? Do I need to practice my radio communications so it would actually be advantageous for me to start off my IFR on the ground and wait 20 minutes or whatever it is? Or, you know, do you want to get in the air and get to your destination? So that goes back to that experience and expediency question is what are you trying to accomplish there? So, but, you know, those are things that you should experience. You should experience how to actually pick up an IFR in the air. So, you know, those are just obviously different situations that you want to try and you want to do. Another couple of questions that are closely related is, when is it inconvenient or too slow to do IFR? So should you really be doing IFR in VFR conditions if your goal and mission for the day is to get somewhere at a certain time? And although we shouldn't use that somewhere at a certain time as an absolute, you know, we always have the decision to say no, even if there are consequences. You know, you don't necessarily need to be doing IFR if it's very restrictive for the area you're in, if your goal is to be somewhere, you know, you don't want to stack that against yourself as far as getting somewhere. So although IFR can actually be expedient in a lot of cases, it can be faster than VFR. You just need to ask yourself, should I be doing IFR or shouldn't I be doing IFR? And, you know, really just, you know, the last one is the conditions. Should you be doing IFR in VFR conditions? And, you know, I've always really enjoyed myself. I've always enjoyed just doing IFR all the time. I find it's easier to work in the system that way when it's just a habit of doing IFR, even if I'm departing VFR first and then picking up IFR. I just feel it better to work in the system all the time, but that's a personal preference. It really depends on, I guess, the flight mission that you are operating in. So that's system savvy. Just some questions and thoughts and ideas to help you understand, I guess, your mission in the IFR system and what your purpose is and how you would like to utilize that time in the IFR system. So next comes communication clarity. So your relationship with air traffic control is very unique. And as a result, you as a pilot need to know what you can request, what you can do, and what you can't do. So you need to know a lot of different scenarios and how to best utilize air traffic control and how to assist them as well. So obviously this is a two-way street. Controllers can help you and you can actually help them too. There are times when they are bound by protocol and can't do what you want. Obviously, you don't always get what you want. And you need to know what to do in those situations as well. So my biggest first thing with communication clarity here is just ask. Ask a controller if you have a question or a request or anything in between, or if you need them to clarify something. It never, ever hurts to ask. Now, I can only envision one situation where it would hurt to ask. If you can tell that everyone else is doing one particular thing and it's a super busy area and they're cramming traffic in and landing them in sequence and it's just really tight and there's really no budge room, like, you'll understand those situations. You'll understand that you can't request another runway without there being a lot of consequences. It's kind of common sense, but, you know, there are a lot of situations where you can ask the controller even clarifying questions or whatever you need whenever you are in doubt of the instruction given or you would like to do something maybe a little different and you would like to request something from them. It never, ever hurts to ask a controller, okay? So that, I think that's probably the golden rule of communication clarity. Next is know your place. So there are a lot of planes in the skies, obviously, and you need to know where you fit. You need to know where you fit in priority. And you're going to experience that a lot, especially as a general aviation pilot. And you'll experience it at different levels as you grow up, if you will, through multi-engine and corporate and up in the jets or airlines, if you're getting there. You'll recognize that the priority handling of air traffic control is different as you grow up through the ranks. So again, you just need to know your place and how all that works. Next is work with the controllers. So this is one of my biggest things in something that I really appreciate when I hear on the radio. And one thing that I really try to do myself is I really try to help controllers. I want to know their challenges in that particular area. I want to know if I'm being a hassle. So if I'm being a hassle and I'm on their scope and they're having to stop traffic at an international airport for this little airplane that's coming into, you know, some satellite field and it's VFR conditions and I can go under Bravo, then I'm going to cancel my IFR and continue VFR with that same controller. And, you know, these are just situations and things that we can help controllers out by making their job easier and so they can focus on the things that really matter. Now, if you needed that IFR, if you were in IFR conditions, obviously you don't want to cancel just to make things easier on the controller. You need to do what you need to do as a pilot And really, that's the overreaching thing of communication, is you are in control of your aircraft and you are responsible at the end of the day. That's the way that any aviation law states it. So that means that even if you have to, you will ignore or break an air traffic control instruction in order for the safety of yourself and your passengers. Now, be careful with that one, because you will have to answer for it if you do it incorrectly. But, you know, that's kind of branching off into a different subject, but really helping out the controllers as much as you can, I think, goes a long way, and they will be more able to help you as a result. And it's kind of this unsaid rule in aviation that you try to help out the controllers, and then they can help out you. And it's kind of this pay it forward or karma type thing that keeps going back and forth between the controllers and the pilots. Obviously, we don't want to be a nuisance to each other. We're there to fly safe. We're there to get to our destination. And that's a goal that everyone has. And so there's that give and take. So that finishes communication clarity. Next is predictable procedures. And this one is a little bit longer. I'll try to breeze through it. But, you know, a perfectly executed procedure is one of the most beautiful parts of being an IFR pilot. All the complexities that come with flying an exact profile and ending up on target at the runway will be sure to build your confidence as an IFR aviator. And confidence is one of the things we really want to get to when we're talking about IMC and being an IFR pilot. So how can you best set yourself up for success? I have a few things here that we can just touch on, and I think we'll just touch on these so we leave enough time for the other segment. But first and foremost, just know your aircraft, know what it's capable of. How does it operate in IFR? What kind of IFR capabilities does it have? That has a lot to do with avionics, but also the performance of the aircraft has a lot to do with the capabilities, you know, what kind of departures you can do and arrivals, things like that. It does matter. So you need to know how to best set up your aircraft for success. That goes to cockpit resource management, you know, actually using the tools around you in order to assist you in doing great approaches and great procedures, departure procedures, arrival procedures. There's a lot of procedures. So you need to know how to best set up your particular aircraft, that unique aircraft, for success. Next is highly scrutinized routines. And the reason why I say I put scrutinized or highly scrutinized in there rather than just routines, is because we don't want to get into routines that are fixed when there may be a problem with that particular routine, okay? So what I'm saying is you don't want to get into a bad routine, and so you want to always be evaluating that routine that you're getting yourself into. And so, again, highly scrutinized routines, but routines are very important. Routines and how you go through the A, B, C, D, E, F, G of how to set up your approach, how to do everything you need to do during a procedure is incredibly important. So setting up a good routine, a healthy routine, is very essential. And, you know, by doing all this, it makes a lot of what you do during your procedure second nature and almost like a checklist in your mind, right? And checklist usage is obviously super important. With all of this, with anything IFR, but we're not really talking about it in this particular episode. All right, so you know, another big thing that was huge for me in really coming to a place where I was confident in IFR was power and configuration envelopes with the particular aircraft I was using. And this could go back to knowing your aircraft, but there are a lot of power and speed combinations and flap combinations, so on and so forth, different configurations of the aircraft where you can essentially set power to a certain place and your aircraft will slow to a certain speed and do certain things where you essentially set it and forget it. And the Bonanza that I once flew was very, very good at this. You set it to a certain power setting, it slowed down to approach speed. You would put down the landing gear at the final approach fix or the intercept, and it would essentially, you wouldn't even have to touch trim or anything else. It would just descend right on the 3-degree glide slope, barely anything else you had to do. So those sort of things help you out a lot. Otherwise, you may get behind the aircraft. But helping the aircraft will help you in getting everything stable and being able to set those certain configurations and knowing that you'll get a certain airspeed, a certain descent, things like that, and that then you can make small, fine adjustments for your particular situation. So those help out a whole lot. And also knowing how to do that in your transition from cruise, the intermediate approach, landing, and obviously different. This is the big place for power configurations, right? And different aircraft configurations, because when you're talking about departures, you're essentially high power, just getting out of there, if you will. So that's important to know as well. Last for this predictable procedures area or subject, if you will, is varying situations. So try flying into new places, try flying different approaches that you aren't familiar with. Just broaden your scope of the system and procedures that you could do and see what you are capable of. So the big idea here is to just keep sharp on all the different types of procedures that you are wanting to do. And by doing all the things that I mentioned, you'll definitely be super solid in your procedures. You want everything to be nice and predictable, and you want to slow things down for yourself. You don't want to be behind the aircraft. And so a lot of these things I mentioned, and obviously some more things that I failed to put in here, will assist you in doing just that, in having predictable procedures. So now we're on to conditioning. So that's a little confusing. What do I mean by conditioning? So the big thing here is to condition yourself and your mind to fly in actual conditions and use that ticket. So don't just become the guy that squeaks by on his check ride. You know, we want you to rock that check ride because you know your stuff, and then cherish the beauty that comes with floating amongst the clouds. That's really what an instrument ticket is all about. You really want to be actually flying in these conditions. This is some of the most beautiful and rewarding type of flying that you can possibly do. And although there's a lot to consider when taking on actual instrument condition flight, it is definitely rewarding. So conditioning means you are conditioning yourself to fly in instrument conditions, okay? So I hope that makes sense. So the big thing here, and first and foremost, is to fly in the actual conditions. Go and fly in what you would, you know, do every day if you had someone saying, I need you to fly here today. You know, I'm not saying do that regardless of what's in front of you, but don't hold yourself back from going to a place or flying into weather. You know, get yourself educated on all you need to know to feel comfortable with getting into that situation, okay? And that goes down to a lot of things, even your ability and confidence in handling the aircraft when you can't see outside the airplane. We just need that confidence to do these things before we actually go in. But again, it's kind of a conundrum because the experience comes from actually going to those conditions. One of the best ways I feel to do this is find an instructor that is willing to fly in actual conditions with you. And so you get a feel for what these things are like. And so you guys can experience it and that it becomes an integral part of your training to know what it's like to be in the clouds, okay? Not with just a hood over your eyes, but actually in the clouds. So the big idea here is to get comfortable and confident. And I've said that so many times. And you know, finding an instructor that'll do that or actually being in those conditions, you'll know what it looks like, you'll know how it feels. It's very different from having a hood on because it's real. Okay. It's not this fake thing where the instructor says, okay, we're getting out of control a little bit, pull up your hood, look outside. It's not like that. You don't have that choice. And so I feel like our minds and our bodies react different when it's for real, okay? So a lot of what goes on that with on with that as well is, you know, decisions are completely different in these situations. We act more sharply, and it just, the real thing has no replacement. And I really do feel that way. And once you've done all these things, once you've flown in actual conditions a lot with your instructor, once you're comfortable with IFR, we'll talk about what that feels like later, but plan on actually using your IFR ticket. Stay proficient. You know, proficiency goes beyond what your governing agency requires you to do. I don't think proficiency for their requirements is enough. I think you should be flying IFR a lot more. You know, I know financial concerns come into play there. But if you're going to get your ticket, just use it. It's a great, great experience to fly in the clouds. Again, you know, I keep using the B word, the beautiful word, but there's just nothing that replaces IFR flight. All right, so now we're going to get to sailing safely. And, you know, we don't have a lot of time here to finish up these subjects, but we may run a little over on this particular podcast. I like to keep it over, or rather just around an hour, but we'll see how we do here. So the next subject is sailing safely. So much of IFR comes down to safety, and we've talked about that a lot. You'll be faced with decisions that are potentially dangerous, but don't let that hold you back from experiencing IFR. There is, you know, a bit of danger in everything we do, I suppose, and you want to mitigate those risks by having the knowledge of all of these things and the experience. But, you know, safety is key. It's connected to everything we do as pilots. So again, get educated, know what is in front of you, and know what situations you're putting yourself into. It'll become obvious when there's too much risk and it's simply time to say no or stop. You need to be able to walk away from the airplane at the airport and do the hard thing at times. So some things you need to know, we'll just kind of browse through these. And although I'm big on human factors, I feel like it's going to be a common thread through a lot of what we do with Aviator Cast. And so I feel like we'll touch on that a lot later and I can breeze through it now. But human factors is a big deal with safety. You need to know what your physical limitations are. You need to know what your mindsets are, or rather mental limitations. All of these things are interconnected. We as humans interact very differently when we're in the air with our bodies. Our bodies do some things like, you know, altitude issues and spatial disorientation issues, and also our decision-making processes and things of that nature that that we need to be aware of. So we'll be touching a lot on human factors. I'm a huge believer in approaching aviation at a core level from a human factors perspective. Also, you need to know how to make a go, no-go decision. You need to be brave enough to not go. I know that sounds silly, but the bravery is often not in actually going into a stupid situation. It's in staying on the ground and just saying, you know, this is too much. I'm going to wait it out. I'll sleep in the lobby at the FBO, whatever it is. You need to be brave enough to not go. Along with that, you need to learn to say no. And we'll talk about that in a few more seconds with passengers, but you need to learn to say no. And I'm just going to leave it at that. Also, you need your own personal minima when it comes to IFR. There are obviously limitations that come with what the government has, you know, the FAA, the JAA, for example. What are your limitations? Obviously, you can't break those rules, but what are your limitations beyond what is required by law? So is that something you need to take a step further and say, you know, this is the rule at 3 statute miles, but my rule is actually 5 statute miles. Those are things that you can investigate as you get more comfortable, or even when you're just starting your IFR training, okay? Or really even just taking your IFR ticket to a different level. I recognize that a lot of you already have an IFR ticket, but maybe many of you want to take it to a new level and actually use that ticket. All right. So I already talked about learning to say no, and that is very related to passenger pressure. Now, you are the boss. You are the leader of the aircraft. You are in control. You are in control when you're not even flying. So you get to say if you go or not. And sometimes you need to be an a-hole and just say no. If that's what you really want to do and that's what you need to do, you need to say no and you need to stand your ground, okay? And if you're flying any sort of passengers regularly, you're going to find that eventually that that you need to say no at some point. So, you know, another, that kind of does it for passenger pressure and, you know, leaving that. But another point here is when you are in doubt, you just shouldn't go. So don't guess. Take the guesswork out of everything you do in IFR by either learning from experience with an instructor or gaining that confidence and then learning little by little. Obviously, we learn a lot before we learn a lot and then we get in a situation where we learn a little bit more, but we're learning at a safe level, you know. We're not putting ourselves in a dangerous situation, in other words, in order to learn more. We're actually learning more safely. So I think a lot of that comes with experience. But you can take the guesswork out of what you do. So if you don't know what you need to know, obviously learn it. If you need help, ask. Those are sort of things that you just need to know. So another big question, and kind of to polish off this sailing safely section, is when to divert. So when you're already in the air and you need to find a place to go and you need to stop your flight, when is it time? When do you say it's time to stop this flight? Obviously, you want to be looking ahead of time and you want to be very aware of what's ahead of you and what's around you and what's going on. And that has to do with your aircraft, your mental state, the weather has to do with a lot of things. And so you need to know and be aware that you can actually divert in flight and that that is always a possibility, okay? So the big thing here, well, I guess the climax of what we're getting to as an IFR pilot is eventually we want it to all come together and just click. We want it to just be this thing that just happens because you've ingrained it in yourself and you're working well through the system. You're communicating well. The procedures are just clicking right along, okay? Now, it does take a lot of work. It takes patience. But you can definitely arrive at a place where your mind, actions, and that passionate aviator spirit all join in harmony to become a sharp and efficient IFR aviator. So it definitely is possible. It's this aha moment, right? It's almost like the clouds part and the light shines through and concourses of angels are around. And you just know at that moment when you do something right and you've completed this wonderful actual instrument condition flight and you've just landed, you know that it's working and you know that you've arrived, if you will, and that you really do have these skills and attributes and knowledge in order to do all of this safely. And it's one of the best achievements you'll ever feel. It's on par with getting your first license or your first solo. So being an IFR pilot is absolutely one of the best things I've ever done as a pilot. Some of the most beautiful experiences as a pilot have come from floating amongst the clouds, accomplishing difficult tasks, and arriving safely at my destination. I just love, love, love IFR. There's just nothing like single engine, single pilot IFR. So that is how to be a solid IFR pilot.
And now, the flight simulation segment.
And now, how to nail virtual jet landings every time. So landing a jet precisely is a lot of fun, but it's a rare and often unseen skill among flight simmers. Have you ever heard or learned of the actual procedure used by real airline pilots to land? My guess is no. It's not really knowledge that's shared. It's kind of actually one of these experiences where I think airline pilots learn it just by experience and not necessarily a procedure like this, but this was explained to me and has really, really helped me out with landing virtual jets. And this is what real pilots use all the time and how they do the final part of their landing. So we'll talk about that. So although we're primarily talking about a visual approach here, that's what we want to get at, you know, kind of branching off from our hand flying segment in last episode, these tips are still very much a part of all the approaches and landings that you'll do. So after this segment, and with a lot of practice, which we'll talk about as well, you will be landing your virtual jets like never before. So getting right into it, I would like to dispel some myths that come with landing a jet. So one thing I heard at one time that really annoyed me was great pilots always make perfect landings, right? So if you're judging a pilot by how smooth his landings are, you're focusing on 0.0001% of what matters in that pilot's toolbox, if you will. So it doesn't have to be an absolutely perfectly smooth landing all the time. In fact, sometimes you actually have to plant the wheels down. That's what you have to do. So we'll talk about that a little bit. So that's one myth. Get that out of your head. You don't have to do this perfectly smooth, squeaky landing. That's not what it's about. And that's not what you're supposed to do. If that happens, great. But you know, you don't need to be measuring the feet per minute upon touchdown. It's just not useful, not the point. And we'll talk more about why that's the case, or you'll see why that's not the case as we talk about, as we go on and talk here. So crosswind versus regular landings, essentially all landings are a crosswind landing. All landings are very different. There's always air moving around, blowing the aircraft to and fro, almost always. And so you're always having to deal with some sort of challenge with controlling the aircraft. You're never going to be able to just leave the control wheel there stationary and just keep lined up and just fly in perfectly. It's just not realistic. So another myth is that jets land themselves and they're easy to land. Completely untrue. This is not an easy procedure. This is actually a very difficult procedure because it happens so fast, especially once you get to the flare stage. So yes, jets do land themselves with auto land, but pilots land them too, okay? It's been happening all this time, and they still do it. Although it is pretty rare, pilots still do land the jets themselves by hand, completely by hand. And it definitely isn't easy. So another myth is that jets land like GA aircraft or general aviation aircraft, and you should be essentially landing in what is often referred to as a controlled stall. That's not how jets land. They, you know, you don't want to hear the chirp of the stall warning horn before you hit the ground. It's a completely different procedure than that. You're essentially driving the aircraft to the landing, and you're not looking or seeking that stall, right? Like you would with a Cessna, for example. And although that's just one technique, I understand there are a lot of different landing techniques than just the controlled stall. Another myth and another thing I hear people say, and this saying in aviation really always bugs me, is that if people walk away, it's a great landing. Okay, that's not true. You want to be able to use your aircraft again. It's not a great landing if people can walk away. So get that out of your head. All right. So we broke this down into an acronym that I just so happened to come up with. I typed this stuff out, and it was an actual acronym. So it actually kind of worked really well. So the procedure is called AFTR, and that's with two F. So it's spelled AFFTR. So it still kind of spells AFTR. I think it works really well. And this is an easy way to remember how to set up your landing correctly. This acronym will ensure you set up a perfect landing if you do it perfectly, and it does that step by step. So if you get one of these steps wrong along the way, it could easily cascade down into the other larger mistakes, and eventually you'll need to go around or you'll screw up your landing. So just keep that in mind, that each one of these procedures or steps is very essential for the success of the next step. All right, so we have the AFTER acronym. The first, which is A, is approach. So getting set up on the approach correctly and having a decent profile, or rather a decent profile, is half the battle. So you really want to get this approach right. So once you're set up and stable, the rest gets a lot easier and can just really just be much, much better. So with approach, you want to be aware of your aircraft configuration. Are you configuring your aircraft at the right time? You need to know when to make your decisions on when to extend the flaps and the gear. Obviously, the flaps come before the gear. That's kind of how it works. You can see that through some of our training products. So, you know, you need to know how to configure your aircraft through that phase, that approach phase, and how to get yourself slowed down and in your landing configuration, if you will. So you also need to know your flight envelope. Are you too fast? Are you too slow? Are you too high? Are you too low? So those are a lot of things you need to constantly be asking yourself and adjusting is your flight envelope. Another thing, and this is, I kind of have a little, math homework here for you with this one, but another big thing is glide slope. You want to be essentially on a good descent angle, much like an ILS to your landing. And so you can do that very, very easily. And we can do that by knowing what vertical speed we should have. Now, a ballpark figure works just fine, and I'm going to teach you how to do that here. And once you use this ballpark figure, you'll be able to do that that 3-degree glide slope just right. So what you do is you half your airspeed and add a zero. So for example, if your airspeed was 150 knots on approach, that was your VREF, then you would basically be at 75, right? That's in half. And then you add a zero. So really, these are the numbers you're looking at. You're looking at 750. So 75 plus a zero. So essentially what this is doing is it's giving you 750 feet per minute in order to do that descent. So you want to be negative 750 feet per minute. That's going to get you on about a 3-degree glide slope at 150 knots. So again, half your airspeed, add a zero. Very, very simple. And again, ballpark works. That's just something you look at yourself as your VREF and ask yourself, what does my descent rate need to be for this particular airspeed? And just do that quick equation. So approach, again, big adjustments first, small adjustments later. You want to get stabilized as soon as possible, because later on down the road or down the approach, big changes won't be possible. It just becomes much more difficult when you get closer to the airport and when your aircraft gets in that that slower configuration with everything out. It just becomes less maneuverable. All right, so the next part of the acronym, an F. We have two Fs here. So the first F is final approach. So at final approach, this is where the procedure gets very specific for a jet, okay? So this other approach stuff that I mentioned, that's pretty basic for any aircraft that you use. But now that we're into this final approach phase and down into the flare and rollout, this becomes quite specific to a jet. So pay attention. These steps are super, super important, and you really shouldn't deviate from them. I haven't put a lot in here of what not to do, but I'll try to mention some of those. So again, we're on the first F of the AFTER acronym, and that is final approach. The first thing you need to do on final approach or at a specific point is you need to go visual. So that means that you are looking outside the aircraft and not using your instrumentation for your guidance, okay? So at about 150 feet at latest, you should be fully visual for the runway. Obviously, we're talking about a visual approach here. I know that you could argue, you know, what about an ILS? Let's not talk about an ILS right now. Let's talk about fully visual. So at 150 feet at latest, you should be fully visual. So that at this point, you almost need no power adjustments. And you won't need a lot of adjustments to align because we set up the approach correctly and your flight profile won't change much at all. So you need to be fully visual outside the airplane. You're not looking at anything inside the airplane, okay? You're not paying attention to your feet per minute or anything. This is where you are controlling the aircraft based on visual references outside the airplane and how all that is looking, going back to the core skills you gained as a VFR pilot. Okay. So also at this point, you should be stabilized and on target. If you aren't stabilized and on target, it's time to go around. If you're not ready to land at this point at 150 feet, it's time to get out of there and try again. You can make this decision at any point to get out of there. So if anything looks off, even before 150 feet or 100 feet or 50 feet, or even if you're on the ground already and things just aren't going well, you can always get out of there, okay? Obviously, there is some point during the rollout where you can't just go around, but if you've touched down the wheels and the slats haven't come up and you're not in reverse thrust, then you can still go around. But, you know, we're talking about final approach here. You always have that decision to make to go around if things just look off. So that's the first F. The next F is flare. So the flare is, in basic terms, when you're transitioning from that descent angle that you have, that you calculated, right? You're transitioning from that to a very smooth touchdown, or as smooth as you can possibly get in most situations. Obviously, not in all situations. You're not always going to want to plant your wheels down smooth as butter, okay? But that is essentially what you're doing, is you're transitioning from that descent angle to an angle or a descent rate or a touchdown worthy, situation. Because if you just kept that one descent rate, you just drive the thing right into the ground. You'd really bend up the aircraft and cause millions of dollars in virtual damage, if you will. So that's what the flare is. But this flare process is the most specific part you need to pay attention to, and this will really, really help you out. I think you guys are going to love this because it gives you some specific guidelines finally on how to land a jet properly. So again, just like the final approach, the flare is based 100% on visual cues. You should not be looking in the airplane. You should not be looking in the airplane at this point. You should be looking outside the airplane using your peripheral vision. And, you know, that's very difficult to do in a simulator, but you should be getting the visual cues from outside the airplane. Okay. All right. So with that said, now everything that I'm about to tell you, all of these next few steps, they all happen simultaneously. So it's kind of like this three-step process or four-step process where you're doing several things all at once to smoothly land the airplane. Okay. All right. So here's what you need to do. Smoothly roll back power at about 50 to 20 feet. So when you hear that altitude call out, you know, I found that 30 feet is where I've really tried to work it into. So you want to smoothly roll back your power between 50 and 20 feet. 50 is a little high, 20 is a little low, and so it's somewhere in between. You can get used to it, but that's when you want to start rolling back your power. So you listen for those altitude call-outs, and you start to roll back that power. So don't be afraid to roll back your power aggressively if you need to, because you're about to touch down. You really don't want to be carrying extra power as you roll out this flare, okay? So this is a very sensitive part of this procedure. And again, like I told you, it's all simultaneous. So you're going to be on a rolling back your power to essentially, which is the next step, you want to be idle by the time you're about to touch down. So when you roll out that flare, you want to be idle on the power, okay? So it's a transition from that descent rate, and then you start to roll out at 50 to between 50 and 20 feet, and then you're pulling out as you're flaring or pulling back on the stick, you're pulling out that power simultaneously. Okay, and don't be afraid to be aggressive with it as well, but don't be too aggressive. You've just got to find that sweet spot. So this transition from where you're at the 50 to between 50 and 20 feet, usually, again, for me, I found it's about 30 feet. After its transition and the thrust rollback, it only takes a few seconds. And you've got two different skills to hone in here at this particular point. We're not to the touchdown point yet. You've got the how fast and how aggressively you're rolling back the power and at what altitude you are actually starting your flare. So you're flaring and pulling that power simultaneously, okay? I hope I've said that enough. I'm just trying to repeat it for you guys so you understand and so you're not missing anything there. So it only takes several seconds. It's very quick. And even just a millisecond on each end matters, okay? Rolling or pulling back too early or starting your power reduction too late. All of this stuff matters in a big way during this entire transition. All right. So the idea with the pitch, and again, this is all simultaneously, is you want to do so smoothly. If you pull back too hard on the yoke when you're doing this flare, then you have the potential of floating the aircraft. And especially if you're carrying too much power at that point, it becomes a big problem if you flared and suddenly you're 20 feet above the runway and you're flared and kind of level and you still have some power in, you're going to be floating a long way down the runway. That's why I say that milliseconds matter when it comes to this, and you'll have to practice this over and over and over again. You just need to watch out for those particular details is really the timing. The timing is huge, so you need to watch out for that. Again, the pitch, this whole process, the pitch and the rollback of the thrust is a simultaneous thing that happens. So now that we've done that, our aircraft should essentially be in a situation where we're settling into the runway. And, this in and of itself, when we've already made a good effort to get the pitch just right, and we've made a good effort to roll back the power, now we're set up to touch down correctly. So this is why earlier I said that you don't need to smoothly land the aircraft. It's not like landing a GA airplane, right? Because with a fun little Cessna, we can squeak landings all day, and it's fun to not even feel the touchdown. But with a jet, you do not want to float. You have a lot of runway, or sometimes too little runway. You have a heavy aircraft to deal with as you're on this runway, and chewing up a bunch of runway by floating too far is just very dangerous. So my point here is, don't be afraid to plant your wheels down. There is nothing wrong with that. At this point, you have idle power. You should essentially be flying the airplane into that touchdown. And, you know, if you're floating too much, you got to fly it down. You're still flying the airplane. You're not just stalling. You actually got to fly the airplane down. Okay. So again, floating is not desired here at all. That is what you're trying to avoid. You're trying to get to that touchdown where you can then get all your stuff out, meaning your slats, and you can start your reverse thrust. You can put that nose wheel down, all of those things to get the airplane stopped. So the touchdown, this entire process takes small, quick, and deliberate adjustments to make sure that the flare process all happens correctly. And really there's no difference between the actual flare and the touchdown. All this all happens within just a few seconds. So these are all like little tiny skills you need to work on, right? So the combination of timing and quality of what you've done during that process will determine how great the touchdown is. So it starts with the approach, really, to the final approach, to the flare, and then that will determine your touchdown. So although, I've said that it's not about touching down smoothly, unfortunately, passengers do determine a pilot's ability to land smoothly. That's how they judge a pilot, is by how smooth he lands. They don't really care that he went across continents to get them where they are. And that in and of itself is an amazing thing. But, that's how pilots are judged. You do want to touch down if you can, if the conditions call for it. smoothly if you can. If you can, there are situations where you don't touch down smoothly. Some of those situations would be if you're in a crosswind landing situation, it is very difficult and you really can't do that smoothly. It's just the aircraft is really doing a lot of weird things if you have a strong crosswind to where you have to get into the place. And often that is quite a hard and aggressive maneuver that you just have to do with the airplane, okay? And it isn't very comfortable for passengers. And another would be if you're planning into standing snow or water on the runway, you don't want to be just landing yourself into a smooth hydroplaning situation. So that's the touchdown, and that's the T in the AFTER acronym. And now we're on to the R. So this is the last part, the rollout. You want to smoothly bring the nose down after landing. And again, you're still flying the airplane. You want to fly that nose down. You're still working with the yoke. So you want to fly that nose wheel onto the runway. During the rollout, you also want to make sure that all of your systems are working properly. Things like auto brakes, slats, and reverse thrust. All of those things start to matter a whole lot at this point because now we need to get the airplane stopped. And then maintaining alignment, just like any other landing, is very important for the rollout. And you need to also think about exiting safely. You don't want to exit too fast. Exiting too late can be potentially annoying for people behind you that are trying to land if things are crowded. So, you know, you want to get off the runway when you can. You don't have to get off too aggressively, but just keep in mind, you know, you need to exit safely and exit in a timely manner. Okay? So remember that acronym, AFTER, A-F-F-T-R, that is approach, final approach, flare, touchdown, and rollout. And, you know, work on what I call the escalation of precision, right? So the further you're getting down that approach path all the way to touchdown, the more and more and more precise you need to be with your control movements to make it happen. But I know that if you do those things, then you can do really, really well with it. So the big key here is that practice makes perfect. This is the big, big thing here. You know, as pilots, we spend very, very little time actually in the flare process because it only takes a few seconds to do this entire procedure, right? So even over the broad career with tens of thousands of hours as a pilot, you're only going to have several minutes to several hours of practice in that actual situation where you're flaring the aircraft, okay? So practice is a big, big thing. So one thing that I really, really recommend, and this is how I learned to do this initially, is save a flight file for each aircraft you love. So what you want to be doing is you want to be setting up varying situations. Most importantly, at least from a beginner's standpoint, is you want to be doing straight in and already stabilized, set up for the approach. So all you have to do is worry about maneuvering the airplane down the touchdown, right? That's all you, well, through rollout I suppose too, but that's all you want to do is worry about doing that over and over again. But you can also try, you know, base to final or downwind. And then what you want to do is you want to be restarting this flight over and over and over again, practicing for hours and just getting it right, okay? Just over and over and over again. And eventually, you'll just nail it, okay? You'll really start to get this down when you're practicing this procedure over and over and over again. And, you know, you can mix it up, like I said, with different situations. You can also mix up the weather and wind and things like that. Mostly just wind. I wouldn't add too much weather. You know, I wouldn't add rain or anything, but mainly add weather, or rather wind. And so you can feel the differences of how that looks. Now, you won't want to add too much wind because then we're talking about a completely different procedure when you're getting into a difficult crosswind landing. Another way to get proficient and stay sharp is to have competitions with friends. I found that to be very fun when I first started, and it just adds kind of an intensity to this whole process to make you nail that target, hit the landing really well when you're, you know, taking turns, seeing who can do a better landing. Okay? So that's essentially what it all is. I mean, practice is a huge thing. And you know, if you know that after procedure, if you will, if you know that after procedure, then you can come in and you can practice all of this. Now, there is actually an add-on out there that is really great for this process, because one of the time-consuming things about this is actually getting your airplane set up for this situation. So it's called FS Instant Approach Pro. And I'll put a link to that in the show notes, and you guys can go and pick that up if you'd like. So essentially what it does is it sets up your airplane on final approach, all set up, ready to go, at a particular distance, and you're set up at that runway. I think you can even choose any runway you want in the world, and it'll just set you up. It also set you up on base. It'll set you up on a downwind if you want that. So a lot of varying situations. And this will just mean that you can focus on this procedure, this after procedure that we have talked about, and you won't have to focus on anything else. So last but not least, I just want to mention this quickly. I have a few more notes here that I'm actually going to share, but you need to know the difference between very light jets, you know, small corporate jets, smaller narrow body jets like 737s, you know, that type, that range, and then wide bodies. Obviously, all of these aircraft, they land differently and have different characteristics, and the cockpit sits higher above the ground than others, or the cockpit is further ahead of the wheels than others. So you need to be aware that, you know, the target for those aircraft are different, the visual cues are different. So just be aware of that. Just be aware of the airplane you're in. And if you're having trouble landing that particular aircraft, ask yourself, you know, is it due to the visual differences of what I'm seeing in this particular aircraft and just the aircraft itself? You know, if the wheels are a couple or 100 feet behind you, then obviously you're going to be landing ahead of your target point. It's just going to be a different. There will be some differences in your approach and your landing procedure, okay? But as far as how this after procedure works, it's all the same. These differences with airplanes mainly come with your target and how it looks when you're flaring. The actual distance that you're flaring at doesn't necessarily change, but it's really the what it looks like when you're going through that procedure, okay? When you're in that mandatory visual phase. So, landing the airplane or the aircraft on your own can be an absolute blast. And I know you guys would love to do that. And you'd love to know how to do great landings, because it is one of those things that is sought out greatly by anyone. Everyone wants to know how to land great, right? And obviously it's a very rewarding experience when you do that correctly. So landing a jet, again, isn't something that is easy, but each little step you do here with practice and repetition will mean that you do really, really well at this. And eventually you'll just get it and it'll make sense and you'll continue to do it really well. So that does it for this episode of Aviator Cast. I want to give credit to Atrocilus for providing us with the great music for this podcast. You can download his aviation-themed album for free by liking Atrocilus on Facebook. And there should be a link to that in the show notes, so go ahead and check that out. And a huge, huge thanks also goes out to the great crew at Angle of Attack. They work very hard to keep things going behind the scenes so we can do great things like Aviator Cast and Aviator 90 and a lot of the things you see here at Angle of Attack that come out in the public. A lot of stuff happens in private that keeps all that going. So big thanks to those guys. Definitely, you know, I am only really the voice of Angle of Attack. They are really the workhorse of everything that happens behind the scenes. So if you love this episode, again, please go to iTunes and review it. It's really easy to get on there and do that. You can also subscribe to the podcast episodes, which will deliver them to you automatically. And you can do that through other services like Stitcher or Zune or Blueberry. There are a lot of services where you can find Aviator Cast. Just, you know, do a Google search if you want to find your particular liking or the particular program you use. Even BlackBerry we have. But the big thing for us, big thing you can do for us as a payback for this episode is just go to iTunes and review this and give us 5 stars if you think we deserve it. That will just help us out a whole lot. If you also want to be notified through email, you can do that at aviatorcast.com. You'll see the subscribe area there for our email. And if you want to learn more about our training products, you can head over to flyaoamedia.com. We can start you out with the basics with our free Aviator 90 course, which is a lot of training for free. But you can also get into instrument procedures with Aviator Pro, which we touch on as well. And that's actually our largest product, believe it or not, is Aviator Pro. Very in-depth, over 100 episodes of instrument flying and multi-engine and communications, VATSIM, all sorts of things. And we also have products for some of the most popular jetliners out there, or jets. And those are for the 737, 747, 777, and MD-11. We have very in-depth and professional products for those particular aircraft that you can also check out, again, at flyaoamedia.com. So thank you so much for joining me on this episode of Aviator Cast. We are truly grateful to have you here and have you as a part of our community and to be so engaged in this wonderful passion for flying things that we have. I just really appreciate you guys being here and hope you continue to enjoy Aviator Cast. And until next time, throttle on.
Cat 5-8 is ready. Cat 5-8 is a short line, turn left heading 235, maintain 2000, runway 25 right, clear for takeoff.
Clear for takeoff, 25 right, United 580.